This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. I'm here at the Edstone Radio Studio in England. It's been a big week in the news. Our panel is eager and ready to discuss the important events from this past week. Here in Edstone, in the studio with me, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And back in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Well, within just a few hours, two vehicular terrorist attacks and an explosion hit Spain. A van mowing down pedestrians in Barcelona Thursday evening, a bomb in Alcanar, another van attack in the coastal town of Cambrils early this morning. Islamists were responsible. It was the sixth time in just over a year that a vehicle has been used to cause mass casualties in Europe. It was Spain's deadliest terror attack in more than 13 years. To learn more about this story, we'll go straight to Richard.
That just about sums up most of what we know about the attack so far. A lot of details are still emerging. I think they're still trying to work out the identity of who was driving the van and this kind of thing. Already we do know that two of the attackers were from Morocco, and also that the Islamic State has claimed responsibility. Typically, the Islamic State are a bit more picky about what they claim responsibility for compared to other terrorist groups. They have a fairly clear-cut set of rules, and it usually requires the perpetrators to have pledged allegiance to the Islamic State prior to carrying out the attack. So it seems like there probably is at least that kind of link between the two, if not more. And on the one hand, I mean, it's the same response we always talk about with Europe. On the one hand, it has people very worried. Spanish Prime Minister talked about terrorism is Europe's main problem right now. So some strong talk on terrorism. At the same time, one of the big responses was also to share pictures of kittens on social media.
This is among Spanish people.
Right. Because the Spanish government, the authorities said, well, please don't show pictures of the attackers, that of the attacks. That's what the terrorists want. A lot of the media have been putting out pictures that are very heavily blurred. And so people have been sending pictures of cute kittens with hashtags related to the attacks to not give in to the terrorists. So we're still, you know, yes, there are people saying, yeah, this is a big problem. You know, it's becoming rather obvious now, like you said, just so many of these attacks by vehicles. And as we say every time, how do you stop that?
Right.
And yet you're just seeing some of these same just really trite responses, the same hashtags, the same platitudes coming from certain segments of the population as well.
Any idea why Spain?
Well, the Gatestone Institute, coincidentally just the day before the attacks, published an article talking about how Spain is about to overtake Greece as the number two destination for migrants entering Europe by sea. There was a video that made it onto the news just a few weeks ago of, you know, this beach resort, and everyone's playing on the beach, and then suddenly this dinghy pulls up and a bunch of people in burqas get out, and they're migrants that have just arrived across the Mediterranean. They kind of walk across the beach. Everyone goes back to building their sandcastles and eating their ice creams. So that's part of it. Just like Islam arriving in Spain is not a recent phenomenon either. If I remember correctly, and I didn't double check this stat, but I think some of these cities like Madrid, Barcelona, you're looking at 10, 20, 25%. I think it's Marseille that's 25% Muslim in southern France, but Barcelona, very heavy Muslim population. So you've also got a huge number of Muslims that have been there for years, and a lot of those have become radicalized just like they have in France. I mean, it seems like it's a mixed bag in terms of attacks in Europe recently. You've got the ones that recent migrants are behind, but you also still have embittered Muslims that have been there for years and years and years. And you've got both of those in Spain. You saw there was a massive terrorist attack in Madrid back in 2004. So I think with those factors, it's not a huge surprise that they're seeing these attacks again.
In some ways, it seems like this was a more sophisticated attack than what we saw in some of these other recent ones, say Nice and Berlin, just because you had coordination and the Spanish authorities actually said that that these were all linked, the two vehicular attacks and the bomb that went off. Obviously, the one in Barcelona, by far the most, the deadliest, something like, 100 people injured, 14 people killed, something like that. I guess those numbers could change. But so it was clearly there was a lot of coordination going on here, and it suggests a high level of premeditation and intent on the part of the terrorists.
I agree. And I think one of the other things that comes out of this is the capacity of the Islamic State to still be able to inspire and perhaps even coordinate these levels of attacks, despite the fact that they've been losing ground in Syria and this kind of thing. Mm. Because you may also remember there was that thwarted terrorist attack in Australia where they came quite close to getting a bomb onto an aircraft. But what I think really worried a lot of terrorist experts is that the Islamic State was basically able to ship all the components and I think a set... components for a bomb via commercial airlines to Australia and then contact locals there, give them instructions on how to turn those components into a bomb. Some people are calling this kind of like the IKEA terrorist model. So they ship that out, the guy builds a bomb, and it was only right at really the end of this process and after some mistakes on behalf of the operative, not really Islamic State, that this happened. And people were saying, well, yeah, we found one of the people who were building their flat pack bomb kit. How many more of these gone out to? And so when you see something like this in Spain, it does start to raise the question that, yes, the Islamic State is losing territory in Syria, but how capable are they still to inspire and carry out these type of attacks? I mean, after all, Al-Qaeda didn't have a state in the same way that the Islamic State did out in Syria.
Do you have any speculation on what the long-term response might be, if this might shift the needle any further forward in terms of, you know, provoking Europe to take a more robust response? It seems like really every single one of these attacks to this point, ultimately, it just ends up with a lot of talk.
Yeah, and I think we'll see more of both those trends. I do wonder, you've got such a divide within Europe these days. You've got kind of the elites in power that share pictures of kittens, and then you've got a growing number of masses that are generally out of power that want something done. And maybe it will just take that the group of people that want something done just to gain more and more power until they have enough support to be able to kick the elites out. So maybe it will just be more of the same. However, in terms of the needle moving, I look at Italy over the last few months. They're responding more to the migrant crisis than to these terrorist attacks. But with their working with Libya, they have actually managed to do some significant things mostly in terms of preventing third-party charities from other nations rescuing migrants and bringing them to Libya. And they're starting to stop these humanitarian organizations or these NGOs from being able to do that anymore. And they've made some progress in shutting that down, which that's about the only angle they've been able to get at that from fairly easily. It's a little... it's not the best PR, I guess, going after NGOs and preventing them from saving drowning migrants. But they're moving in the direction of stopping this. So maybe that's an indication that we are seeing some shift, but maybe you're just going to have to see the entire current political class kicked out of office, which is something that could happen very quickly. It's one of those kind of massive events that could happen almost overnight. But maybe you're going to have to see that before you see Europe actually doing anything to stop terrorism.
Well, we are going to talk about that NGO situation that you just brought up a little bit later on in the program. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We'll shift our attention to a couple of stories about Iran now. First, this past Tuesday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani made an interesting statement before Iranian lawmakers. He said that if America keeps putting on economic pressure over its nuclear program, well, things could get very ugly very quickly. For this, We're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, basically this came in response to a lot of the increased sanctions that the United States is beginning to put on Iran, sanctioning the IRGC and other organizations. And Rouhani, this so-called moderate, basically stood up and said, I'll actually quote him. This is what he said on Tuesday in front of lawmakers. He said, if they, the U.S. administration, are willing to repeat previous experiences, Iran will certainly, within a short period, not on a scale of weeks or months, but on a scale of hours and days, will return to a much more advanced position than when the talks started. So basically what he's saying there is if the United States looks like they're going to back down on their bargain as part of the nuclear deal, which apparently, according to them, means increased sanctions on Iran because they're not giving them the economic windfall that they promised, then he says we may just tear up that deal ourselves, and we have the ability to start producing once again to at a scale, producing enriched uranium at a scale that would put us back to where we were almost instantaneously, which is stunning, really, because it shows Iran's ability. It shows the inability of the nuclear deal to actually curtail Iran's nuclear program. The fact that they could flick the switch so quick and get everything up and running so fast shows that it's not much of a deal. But this is what they're putting on the table. They're saying to the United States, hey, we are able to do this really quick if you don't back down.
Well, it also shows pretty resoundingly just how just Iran's intentions from the very beginning. It's not like they went into this deal with any kind of good faith effort to curb their own program. That they say, well, if there's anything that we don't like about what's going on here, we're going to just ramp it up to the level that we would have done had the deal never been struck in the first place.
Exactly. The nuclear deal has been sold as a solution to Iran's enrichment and production of nuclear material, material that could be used in a nuclear weapon. Basically, all it did was stipulate that Iran turn off their nuclear program, hit the switch, shut it down. You don't have to get rid of all your centrifuges. You don't have to tear down everything, all your nuclear infrastructure. You can ship out of the country even some of your yellow cake, some of your nuclear components. But it didn't say Iran's done. It didn't say Iran, you have to tear it all down, destroy it like what happened in South Africa. That was a wholesale removal of their nuclear program. It was basically flick off the switch. And then in 10 years' time, hey, Iran, if you've been good, we're going to let you continue to work from where you were at. That's basically the deal. And Iran is acknowledging that right now. And they're saying, hey, we are going to, and as Callum Wood brings out in his article on thetrumpet.com, we're going to use this nuclear option as blackmail on the United States now. The nuclear blackmail. You don't do what we like, we can start producing once again. And I think what's interesting is they could have, if they started right now, they could have 25 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium in just 2 or 3 months. They would have, by the beginning of 2018, enough material for a number of nuclear warheads. They've continued the ballistic missile technology, ballistic missile test to ensure that they have a carrier for these nuclear weapons all throughout since the deal's been in place. So they've been developing that. But even if they tear all this up tomorrow, we could have we would be at the situation that we were in 2013, 2014, almost instantaneously.
I wouldn't expect that anyone who has been a fan of Rouhani or really given him credit for having actual moderate credentials would be swayed by this. But it seems like this really does demonstrate the kind of a man that we're really dealing with in Iran's president.
Well, it's still extremely popular for an Iranian president to trade barbs with the United States. He can't back down. When the United States looks like it's going to put on sanctions, unless he wants to lose all his public support completely, Rouhani definitely has to give this type of rhetoric. And let's be clear, he is more of a moderate if you want to compare him to Ahmadinejad, of course. But at the same time, his goals don't differ from the Ayatollah. He believes in Islamic nation, and that should export its Islamic values all over the world. That's his way. And this is just proof that he is willing to use the nuclear option to accomplish that.
Read more about this story on thetrumpet.com. Callum Wood has an article there. Iran threatens to scrap nuclear deal. Gives a little more detail what we're talking about here and some links to what we've written in the past on this subject that really are playing out in today's headlines. We appreciate that, Brent. So Iran has been hosting an intriguing visitor for the past 10 days, North Korea's number two official and the president of Pyongyang's Supreme Assembly, Kim Jong-nam. Amid all the pressure on both Iran and North Korea today, the collusion between these two rogue states seems closer than ever. To learn more about this, we're going to go to our Edmond studio and Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we've all seen that North Korea has been really dominating the headlines in the Western world over the past few weeks and months just because of all those rapid advances it's making in its nuclear and missile programs, and also because of the increasing frequency and belligerence and specificity of the threats to use those weapons against the U.S. But there's one aspect of that North Korean story that the Western media doesn't seem to be calling that much attention to. And as you said, it is the cooperation between North Korea and Iran. And it's alarming that that's not getting that much press because it's probably the most dangerous aspect of North Korea's behavior. Or it could be argued that it is. And as you said, the most recent evidence of the cooperation between these two rogue states came earlier this month. It was just after the UN had slapped a new set of sanctions on North Korea. And at that time, Kim Jong-nam, who is the number two official in North Korea, he traveled to Iran there to attend the ceremonies for Hassan Rouhani, his inauguration. And you know, he's the number two person in all of North Korea. So it's a very significant visit. And he stayed there for about 10 days just to work toward building warmer relationship, warmer ties with Iran, and to improve their economic relationship in a way that would help to offset those new sanctions. So that was, it was clear evidence of North Korea working with Iran, but it's really only the very latest example of it. The relationship between these two has been growing since all the way back in the 1980s, when Iran was trading in oil with the Koreans. And more recently, those economic ties have blossomed into a military bond. And the fact that many of Iran's missiles and submarines are based on North Korean designs makes that clear. And this used to be sort of a one-way street with weapons technology flowing from North Korea to Iran. And that's still the bulk of it. But lately, the relationship seems to have become more mutual and more symbiotic, I think. I've got a quote here from Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He said, quote, "In the past, we would see things in North Korea and they would show up in Iran. In some recent years, we've seen some small things appear in Iran first and then show up in North Korea. And so that raises the question of whether trade, which started off as North Korea to Iran, has started to reverse." So the most alarming aspect of this is in nuclear weapons cooperation between these states. Back in February, the Begin-Sadat Center for Strategic Studies published a really sobering report showing that Iran is making quick progress toward a nuclear weapon thanks to steady help from the North Koreans. One quote from that report says, "From the 1990s onward, dozens, perhaps hundreds, of North Korean scientists and technicians apparently worked in Iran in nuclear and ballistic facilities." And then the report shows that back in 2007, when a key Syrian nuclear reactor was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike, it turns out that that reactor was built by North Korea and heavily financed by Iran. So this is it's a really alarming partnership, especially since news about it seems to be ignored in large part by those who think that the Iran nuclear deal is working and that that was a positive development. This North Korea-Iran partnership should be getting a lot of attention, and it should be brought to an end because it's built on their shared hatred for the West and their shared goal of becoming full-fledged nuclear powers. Callum Wood also wrote an article for thetrumpet.com about this. It was published on Monday, And I'll just read one short quote from his article. It says, "The relationship between the two regimes is founded on a volatile concoction of missile technology and a hatred of the West. As such, we have seen a steady increase in collaboration as both their weapon stockpiles and hatred grow." So it's a powerful article that Callum has up there. So I would encourage anyone who wants more information about this just to check in and read that.
Yeah, excellent analysis. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. It is amazing as these situations in both theaters with North Korea and with Iran escalate. And as you said, they're both getting quite a bit of attention. Obviously, North Korea more lately. But when you look at, say, the developments within North Korea's capacity and you just project those onto Iran, you know, obviously they've got their nuclear capacity and their missile capacity, and both of those nations are trying to develop both of those technologies. You could see the whole situation in Iran becoming far more dangerous. I mean, North Korea is shooting missiles into the ocean, but from Iran, the same kind of technology that it reaches Europe, it reaches a whole lot of places that would be very much under the threat of Iran using that against them. So it does. This is actually a major point that Gerald Fleury, our editor in chief, has been making for a period of years, just talking about the collusion between North Korea and Iran. He brings the point out in this new booklet that he's just finished. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door, and talks a lot about just how the whole Iranian connection adds a substantial dimension to the developments that we're seeing in the North Korea situation. Well, thank you for that. You are listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story here before we take a quick break. Venezuela's economy is collapsing, and recently, President Nicolas Maduro visited Cuba to pay his respects on the occasion of what would have been Fidel Castro's 91st birthday. Is that right?
It would have been. Yeah, actually, this Sunday will be his 91st birthday. But he went up a couple days early to pay his respects.
So evidence is increasing that Cuba is actually responsible for propping up the government of Venezuela. For this story, we'll turn to the man who just answered my question there, Mr. Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is definitely a long-standing trend that's been going on for a while, although this visit this weekend really does cast a big spotlight on it because, I mean, so far there's been at least 120 people killed in street protests in Venezuela. There's been several military officials that have defected. The country is really on the verge of a civil war. And so Nicolas Maduro, he's definitely got problems on his hand propping up his regime. So it actually would almost seem kind of strange that just with how much is going on in Venezuela right now that he'd kind of leave all of that behind for a day or two to go up there to pay his respect to a communist dictator who died a year ago. But it does actually just really show us just how involved Cuba's been over the last several years with the Venezuelan government. There was even back when Hugo Chavez was alive, there was even some talk or rumors that he may be Castro's successor to United Cubazuela, or just merging the two countries. And now with Nicolas Maduro, we haven't heard so much talk along those lines, but his personal bodyguard is composed of Cuban officials. 50 of his high-ranking military officers are Cuban generals. He's got 4,500 Cuban soldiers in his military. I think I saw somewhere that it was like up to over 1,000 Cuban intelligence officials in his regime, 34,000 Cuban medical officials. And so it is really getting to the point, especially with Venezuelans defecting from the military and these street protests, that he's almost gotten to the point where he's not actually almost willing to fully trust any of his own people. So he keeps bringing in high-ranking generals and spies and intelligence officers and doctors and bodyguards from Cuba to keep his regime alive.
And what's in this for Cuba?
Cuba? Well, right now, obviously, Cuba, it's has under pretty bad economic troubles. So for one, Venezuela, which is a major oil producing state, even though they desperately need the money, they still give a ton of oil to Cuba at a very discounted price.
Mm-hmm. So apart from, I guess, you know, birds of a feather flocking together, what does this tell us about Cuba and Venezuela? And it seems like without this support from Cuba that the Maduro government would be in a far, far shakier position than it is as it is.
Right. I mean, and there's definitely there is kind of the one thing that's keeping the Maduro government up. And there's even been some talk of that if Maduro's government were to fall, him and his inner circle would probably go into exile in Cuba or seek asylum in Cuba. So there is definitely just like they're very similar socialist economic systems and both very anti-American, which is it just really shows some of the foreign policy blunders of even the previous American administration, where as part of Barack Obama's opening up Cuba for trade with the United States, they had to remove them from the terrorist sponsoring list. And so he says, okay, he said, we don't have any evidence that they're sponsoring terrorism anymore. So we're going to lift these sanctions. And then with this this civil war in Venezuela, it's definitely coming out that they've definitely really been propping up the Maduro regime, which is basically sponsoring terrorism. I mean, they don't think the Venezuela is officially listed as a terrorist sponsoring state in U.S. documents, but I mean, it is propping up this this totalitarian government oppressing its own people. Even the vice president of Venezuela has really close connections to Hezbollah in the Middle East, and been was caught giving hundreds of Venezuelan passports to Hezbollah operatives to come into Venezuela to raise money by they partner with the drug cartels and then actually use money spent by American drug consumers to finance wars in the Middle East. It's a huge fundraising operation. So between Cuba and Venezuela and Hezbollah, they're definitely all in bed with each other and fostering this civil war south of America that is really going to inflame the situation and make the pressures put on the U.S. migrant crisis much worse.
Terrible stuff. Well, thanks for reporting on that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about an intensification of fighting in the Central African Republic, a terrorist attack in Burkina Faso, tensions between NGOs and the Libyan Coast Guard over migrants, whether the Trump presidency's policy toward North Korea is really different from that of his predecessor, and the Australian Defense Force deciding that for the next 12 months, it's only going to recruit women. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Central African Republic is one of the world's poorest countries. It's been in a brutal civil war since 2013. And for the last 3 years, French peacekeeping forces have tried to end the violence there. Well, after it briefly looked like things were improving, now the intense fighting between armed rival Christian and Muslim groups is getting worse. For this story, we're going to go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so France, as you said, got heavily involved to try and stop a lot of the fighting that was taking place there in the Central African Republic. François Bozizé was ousted, and then this led to a lot of fighting between the Muslim Salika coalition and then the Christian anti-Balaka militias. And so France got involved, and they basically, well, they almost literally declared mission accomplished about last year. They said the French defense minister, the then French defense minister, said you had three missions, speaking to the troops, to end the chaos, accompany the international forces, and enable the holding of elections. These three missions are fulfilled. No one can contest that. And Like we've talked about on this program, France has a lot of economic problems. France has also deployed tens of thousands of soldiers to their own streets to try and combat terrorism, like we were talking about in the first half. Their military resources are really stretched, and so they were looking forward to pulling out of the area. However, it's not that simple at all. The Central African Republic is a huge country, and a lot of the violence is continuing. You're getting a lot more armed groups. You're getting thousands displaced. The UN aid chief, Stephen O'Brien, he recently warned of the early signs of genocide in the country. You're getting UN peacekeeping forces getting killed, Red Cross workers getting killed, volunteers getting killed. So, a bad situation and one spiraling out of control.
We've talked quite a bit about just how involved Europe is, really using, say, North Africa as a staging ground for military operations. And, you know, there's obviously, it seems like an endless number of places there that are disintegrating and that have, like, Islamic terror groups that are, there are plenty of situations to deal with. There was a terrorist attack in Burkina Faso this week. Well, maybe you can just talk about that a little bit and just the overall situation that is happening in Northern Africa and just how Europe is responding to that.
Right. Yeah. If you just look at events this week, you had, like you said, 18 killed at least in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, the capital there. In a restaurant, you had on Monday, you had a set of gunmen attack the UN's military base in Timbuktu. Again, there were Burkina Faso soldiers there. Seven were killed in that attack, but that's in nearby Mali. There has been, Mali's kind of in some ways like the Central African Republic. Europe went in there. They did have a lot of success initially. It's still a lot better than it has been, but it remained. The Mali mission is the UN's deadliest military or the deadliest peacekeeping mission in the world. There's a lot of violence going on there. So what you have is it's been referred to as an arc of instability. There's one German general who kind of called it a ring of fire all around this region. You've got this whole cross-border area where radical Islam is fighting Europe, basically. And it was some years ago in an article called Watch Algeria that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory, it was a 2013 article, he began that North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormous important prophetic implications. And that is exactly what we see. And we're just seeing that battleground wasn't solved, say, 2-3 years ago when Germany launched its heavy deployment in Mali, when France moved into the Central African Republic. It's still ongoing. They're still conflict going on between these groups. So you're seeing this uptick in terrorist attack, and then you're seeing Europe making their moves, and Germany has been increasing its military budget. They have been very heavily involved in Mali. It's a very significant for Germany deployment there, I think around nearly 1,000 troops. But at the same time, they do not want to undertake this alone. The European resources are stretched. If they are going to spend more on the military, it's going to have to come, apart from Germany that's got a budget surplus, it's going to have to come from social programs and this kind of thing. That's something they're reluctant to do. So they're looking at, can they do more to create or to work with local militaries? And you see this in training missions. Europe and or Germany and France have this initiative they've been getting behind over the last few months to create this army, basically, that comes from several of these states, including Burkina Faso and I think the Central African Republic and several others. It's called one of the names for it is G5 Sahel Joint Force. There's a few different names for it, but a pan-nation European or African force under European guidance and training to try and deal with these cross-border terrorist attacks. So you're seeing more European troops, but also Europe being basically trying to create their local client forces to deal with the problems too.
The quote that you gave from Gerald Flory was that this has enormous biblical ramifications. Why don't you just help us to understand this from a prophetic standpoint?
Right, so you're seeing, on the one hand, one of the biggest prophecies that we're watching in the end times, it revolves around Daniel 11, and it talks about this clash between a southern power, king of the south, and a king of the north. And for years, and we've got whole booklets on this that you can read to prove this. We've talked about how the king of the south is radical terror led by Iran, and then the king of the north is this European power led by Germany. And you see in North Africa radical Islam pushing against Europe. You see Europe has a lot of energy interests. France has a lot of old colonial ties. They are behind a whole bunch of different leaders, not all of whom are democratic in that area. They need North Africa. And then even beyond those energy ties, they've got the migrant crisis, and a lot of these people that are being displaced by terrorists move north and come and join that wave of migrants moving over into Europe. So it's a push that directly affects Europe. And the prophecy talks about Europe responding, and it talks about them responding in a whirlwind fashion. And Trumpet editor in chief Gerald Flurry talks about how that there's kind of a coded message in that word whirlwind. It's talking about surrounding the king of the south, surrounding Iran, and about how Germany is building bases around Iran so that they can take care of this. And you look at, like I mentioned briefly, some of the what German generals are saying, talking about a ring of fire, for example, and they've talked about how there's kind of a ring of fire around the Middle East and about how Germany needs to be involved in this ring of fire to combat it. They're talking about trying to use, they've talked about building up their base in Mali as a staging post to get involved in across Africa. There are German generals very keen to get more involved in Libya, and they want to use Mali as a staging post in that. I think politicians higher up aren't as keen on that. But you see discussions from the German military and German think tanks very much along those same lines. We're creating these bases, we're surrounding Iran, and we're doing that in order to project power from these bases and come in and bring radical Islam under control that way.
Well, very good. That leads nicely into the next story, this tension between North Africa and Europe. One very specific area that is a cause of that contention is these migrants that are flooding across the Mediterranean from Libya. We were talking recently about this path of migrants from Libya. This week, the Libyan Coast Guard banished nonprofit organizations from its territorial waters. Increased hostility between Libyan authorities, the Libyan Coast Guard, and these NGOs. This week, also, three NGOs suspended migrant rescues in the Mediterranean because of this increased hostility. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So in early August, we reported on this, where the Italian parliament, they passed a bill, I guess, that allowed some of their ships to operate inside Libyan waters. And that was at the behest of one of the governments inside Libya. They said, please help us curb the migrant issue by coming into our territorial waters. And Italy jumped at this and said, let's do it. They sent down a couple of ships to do that. And now this week, as you said, on Sunday, then Libya said, well, we're joining in on this. The Libyan Coast Guard said that we're following suit. We're going to ensure that there are no NGOs operating just off our coast. These NGOs, while they do have a it's hard to really tell what their motivation is to save people's lives from crossing into dangerous waters across the Mediterranean. But they also promote that type of activity, because as soon as they get outside Libyan waters, or even sometimes inside Libyan waters, their boats are there to pick up those vessels that are almost going to sink, that would never make it across the Mediterranean. And then they basically, in there, once these migrants jump onto these vessels of the NGOs, they travel into international waters, then they're picked up and they're taken into Europe. So this needs to stop. And so you've got Libya teaming up with Italy, to the point now that these NGOs, with a number of their ships, are pulling out. To the point that just this past week, on August 14th, we had one vessel, the Golfo Azzurro, which was operated by the Spanish humanitarian organization Proactiva Open Arms. It was targeted, and warning shots were fired at it from the Libyan Coast Guard as it was inside their territorial waters. So these NGOs are getting targeted. It wasn't, you know, shot down or sunk, but it shows that they are serious. And it indicates if all these NGOs leave these territorial waters, there will be no one to report on exactly what's happening between the Libyan Coast Guard and the Italian Coast Guard as they get more deeply involved with one another.
Just looking at this from a practical standpoint, it seems like Italy wouldn't necessarily be too upset by NGOs not bringing more migrants over into Europe, for the Libyan government to take this strong stance against these organizations. It is reducing the numbers of migrants who are making that trip. What happens next?
Yeah, it is. We've seen that, and even the Italian government, they're very happy with Libya's decision to do this. I think they were coerced, Libya, by the Italians to do this for sure, to stop the migrants from coming in. But what you're going to have if these migrants do not even make it onto a boat or outside Libyan territorial waters, you have an even worse situation developing inside Libya as Libya becomes this destination where thousands of migrants are stuck, creating an even more volatile situation in that country, a more destabilized situation on the ground there. And I think that is what we'll see because of this. And that even gets to what Richard was talking about, how Europe is going to have to increase its operation in Africa itself, on land in Africa, which is something we've said that they were going to do.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, a Week in Review program. U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wrote an op-ed piece this week in the Wall Street Journal. The title, "We Are Holding Pyongyang to Account. The U.S., its allies, and the world are united in our pursuit of a denuclearized Korean Peninsula." A lot of tough talk coming out of the Trump administration. But when you look at the reality of what's happening here, the question is the policy really a departure from that of his predecessor, and which was really handed down from his predecessor or a couple of administrations before him? To answer this question, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this op-ed basically lays out the Trump administration's North Korea policy. And reading through it the first time, I found it to be, to have quite a few pretty powerful statements about America's resolve to denuclearize North Korea and to systematically dismantle Kim Jong-un's ballistic missile program. There are some powerful statements in there. It talks about the U.S. rejecting its failed policy of strategic patience toward North Korea and replacing it with a new policy of strategic accountability. One section from this piece says, quote, "The international community holds one view regarding North Korea's provocative and dangerous actions. They must stop. Pyongyang must stand down on those actions." And then from there, it goes on to talk about China's role and the unparalleled leverage that China has over the North, and just says China must use its influence to show the world how a great power should act to resolve such a well-defined problem. And then it mentions the United Nations Security Council's role and Russia's role. And Mattis and Tillerson really urged the UN to enforce the sanctions that they all recently voted in. One other quote from the piece says, "While diplomacy is our preferred means of changing North Korea's course of action, it is backed by military options." And then I'll just read the concluding paragraph from this piece. It says, "Any attack will be defeated, and any use of nuclear weapons will be met with an effective and overwhelming response. North Korea now faces a choice: take a new path toward peace, prosperity, and international acceptance, or continue further down the dead alley of belligerence, poverty, and isolation. The U.S. will aspire and work for the former and will remain vigilant against the latter." So it sounds pretty good. It sounds like a pretty powerful statement there, but the problem is, they claim that this is a departure from the failed policy of strategic patience that was used under the Obama administration. But if you really look into this, you have to ask how it's actually different. And really, as you said, a comparison of it shows that it's essentially what the U.S. policy has been, even dating back to the Clinton administration, which signed a nuclear deal to supposedly prevent the North from ever developing nuclear weapons. So you can just go down the checklist here. Multilateral economic sanctions and urging nations like China and Russia to cut ties with North Korea. Check. You know, it's that's always been our policy. Continuing to demand total denuclearization. Check. Promises of force while also kind of forswearing any actual military resolution. Check. Pleading with China to essentially take care of the problem itself. Check. You know, it's all basically the same. The only real innovation that I can see in this Mattis-Tillerson policy, which is, you know, essentially the Trump administration's policy, is that they are demanding that the North cease all nuclear and missile tests as a prerequisite for negotiations ever beginning. So really, this looks like just more of the same policies that got us to this point at which North Korea has legitimate ICBMs and miniaturized nuclear weapons that could be delivered on those missiles. And I think it's just unrealistic to believe that a few more years of the same threats and the same sanctions and more of the same of everything else would finally force Pyongyang to suddenly just surrender its illegal nuclear and missile programs. So since U.S. policy is more of the same, I think we should expect more of the same from North Korea, just the threat to remain and even to grow stronger.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We're going to have to cut it off there. The Australian Defense Force made an unusual announcement this past week. Recruiters were told that in the name of diversity, they need to be a lot more firm about recruiting women into the force and put some quite remarkable techniques into action to get more women. To learn about this, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. The Australian Defense Force has a goal that within the next 6 years, by 2023, they want 15% of their Army, 25% of their Navy, and 25% of their Air Force to be composed of women. And they're having a hard time. They're not on track to meet that goal yet, so they're starting to put in some stricter measures to make sure that they hit those quotas. And as you mentioned, it says for all practical purposes, for the next year, they're only going to be recruiting for women. Doesn't necessarily mean they won't take an application from a man, but they won't be recruiting for those positions. They said that in particular, they've got 18 Navy jobs open, which they want at least 17 of those to be filled by a woman. 7 Air Force jobs open. They want all of those to be filled by a woman. And there is kind of a strange footnote here is that apparently that they're said if you're Aboriginal, then it doesn't matter if you're man or woman.
Well, that's so diversity, too.
Right. I guess that's probably, that must be what it is. It's diversity because I'm pretty sure your sex isn't influenced by your race. But...
Right.
So, but this is so, a yeah. But
so,
this is,
any idea that these are policymakers who just decided an arbitrary number, 15% of this force, 25% of this, 25% of that. Any idea, or do they have any explanation why they feel like this is actually going to make the Australian defense a stronger force?
Well, it is definitely. Right along with that whole mantra you hear so much that, like, diversity is our strength. And they're definitely trying to recruit strongly for frontline things that obviously, from a physical standpoint, on a rule of averages, the average man has 60% over... the average woman only has 60% of the body strength of the average man. So it's definitely not increasing the muscle power of the Australian military. But... it is along with their goal of, I guess, making a more inclusive society or a more inclusive military, whether you're, even if your soldiers have to be, your average soldier strength has to be a little weaker to include that.
I guess the bottom line of this story is really just the amazing measures that they're willing to go to in the interest of these kinds of arbitrary determinations that complete a predetermined idea of the optimal diversity that you want in your force. We're willing to basically turn our back on the men who would fill our ranks for at least the next 12 months just in order to aggressively go after those who really aren't necessarily interested in joining, certainly not to the same degree as these very capable men, but we have to prioritize the diversity over force readiness, over the desire of the recruit to do the job.
Right. It is definitely a classic example of the equal outcome versus equal rights thing, to where a couple decades ago, I mean, people would have proudly claimed that men should step up and defend women. And then more recently, you've come to the idea like, well, we shouldn't turn anyone who wants to fight from their country away. Anyone who wants to apply, we can accept. And then they're finding that there's still this cultural belief that men should defend women. So men were still applying and women weren't. So now they're like, okay, well, if we're going to actually do the equal outcome, forget equal rights, is like, says we can't even accept men for the next 12 months. It's like only women can apply to the military. So it's, we'll find a way to hit our 15% of the military being women, whether they want to apply or not.
Quite a story. You can read about it on thetrumpet.com. Kieran Underwood has an article there called Australia's Defense Wants Women. Check it out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Brent.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, for Palestinian refugees announced on Monday that it had sealed a Hamas terror tunnel built under two of its schools in the Maghazi refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. The tunnel was discovered at the beginning of June after the Maghazi Elementary Boys School and the Maghazi Preparatory Boys School had been closed for the summer. This tunnel is further proof of Hamas's strategy to use Gazans as human shields, a war crime and a terrorist tactic aimed at exploiting the moral sensibility of the enemy.
And now to Jeremiah.
America is at economic war with China. Those were the words of Steve Bannon on Wednesday. He's the Trump administration's chief strategist. And in an interview with the American Prospect, he said, quote, "We've come to the conclusion that they're in an economic war and they're crushing us. The economic war with China is everything," end quote. And then from there, Bannon warned that the U.S. would be on the cusp of an inflection point in which China could surpass America within a decade as the world's number one superpower. Bannon said the Trump administration must be maniacally focused on its economic war with China, and he said if America loses, it may never recover.
Okay, over to Andrew.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called yesterday for the removal of all Confederate statues from Washington, D.C. She's asked House Speaker Paul Ryan to join Democrats in supporting this legislation. This call comes in the midst of a series of rallies across the country over the issues of Confederate statues. Seven people were also arrested this week for the illegal toppling of a statue in North Carolina.
Okay, and now to Richard.
There's been yet another neo-Nazi extremist scandal in the German military, this time coming from Germany's elite Special Forces Commando Unit. They're accused of having a party a few weeks ago at which people were doing Nazi salutes, listening to kind of neo-Nazi rock music, having a pig head toss, which is apparently something done by neo-Nazis in Germany because both Muslims and Jews don't eat pigs. And there've been a couple of probes now opened into these. By itself, it might just be an isolated incident, but this comes after just a series of similar or even bigger scandals within the German military, and is making more and more ask whether the German army has a problem here of kind of revering its Wehrmacht Nazi era heritage.
And now to Jeremiah.
The bloodiest 24 hours of the Philippines' war on drugs happened on Tuesday when President Rodrigo Duterte's police forces shot 32 people dead. This brings the total body count up to about 7,000 in the year since Duterte has been president. Human rights groups have accused Duterte's police of acting with impunity and of purposefully staging shootouts to kill drug dealers and drug users without giving them the right to a trial that their constitution guarantees them. This week, as he is has done before. Duterte replied to these accusations by saying the human rights activists should be shot if they keep on objecting to his extrajudicial methods.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
CBS News reported earlier this week that Iceland is leading the world in eradicating Down syndrome. The Icelanders haven't actually developed a new medical technique for treating the chromosomal disorder, but have instead aborted almost every baby diagnosed with the disease. About 87% of expecting mothers undergo a prenatal screening in Iceland, and almost 100% of those who find that their child has been diagnosed with Down syndrome abort the fetus. This has led to where only 2 children per year are born with Down syndrome in Iceland.
Eugenics is back. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can give us your feedback by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Elbert Hubbard. Genius may have its limitations, but stupidity is not thus handicapped. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.